the way memory works. You know what I mean? Oh, good. We should do a show about that.
Just find something about it.
So, Casey, how are we doing? Are we ready to go? Perfect. I'm Rebecca McEnroy with KUT, and thank you, my one fan. I love this show. Franz Kafka once said, "My fear is my substance and probably the best part of me." Whereas Franklin Roosevelt said, "The only thing to fear is fear itself." And I could go on and on about quotes on fear and the various perspectives. People relate differently to fear across the board. And as much as fear can be paralyzing, it can also be motivating and mobilizing. So, what is fear? What is going on in our brains when we experience fear? Here with me to discuss fear and the brain, we have KUT's two guys on your head. Professor of psychology and founding director of the program in the human dimensions of organization, Dr. Art Markman. Welcome. And the other half of two guys, the head of music and learning at the University of Texas at Austin, Professor Dr. Bob Duke. Welcome. So let's start out by talking a little bit about what fear is. You know, physiologically, what's going on in our brains? What is fear?
So, all right. Fear is this right now. No.
The quantum theory of fear.
That's right. The quantum. 30 seconds. So, in your brain, there are two different motivational systems. There's what's called the approach motivational system and the avoidance motivational system. And the approach motivational system is the one that gets you towards the really desirable things, which might be good food or good friends or a drink or something like that. And then there's the avoidance system, which is the system that kicks in to try and keep you away from the things that are really noxious, things that might be dangerous. You know, in our ancestral times, that might have been a tiger jumping out of the woods. It might be a bus bearing down on you, or it might be an exam that's coming up. And when the avoidance system engages, the way it communicates with the rest of your brain is really primitive. It doesn't have a lot of language to it. What it does is it creates a bunch of feelings that you experience. And when that avoidance system kicks in, one of the primary feelings that you get is the one that you end up interpreting as fear.
Okay. And one of the things I just want to add to what Art just said, and it's implicit in what he said, is that fear has multiple dimensions to it. It's not just one thing, right? I mean, certainly if you think about the physiological responses that our bodies have that we interpret as fear, maybe an increased heart rate, respiration goes up, maybe constriction of blood vessels. I mean, lots of things happen when we're fearful of something. But actually, if you think about it for a minute, those things happen with other emotions as well. I mean, if I'm anticipating something lovely happening, my heart rate will go up, my respiration might increase a little bit. Except now there's an intellectual component that interprets those feelings, that interprets what my physiological body is doing, and interprets them as a fear response. Now, I think most people hypothesize that a fear response probably precedes a lot of the other emotions that we advanced primates experience. But I think one of the important things to think about right off the bat is the multidimensionality of fear, right? There's a cognitive component, there's an emotional component that we think about as a feeling, and there's a physiological component as well.
And the classic version of this, right, is the experiment on that looked at how it is that people end up making these interpretations,
yeah.
Right? And I love this. This is the one where they brought people on a tour in Canada across a gorge, big mountains, and there's this really high pass there. And there were two ways to get across the mountain pass. One was on a big concrete and steel bridge, and the other was on kind of a rickety, chain link and wooden bridge. And so they brought these tours either across the big concrete and steel bridge or across the rickety bridge. And of course, when you go across that rickety bridge, you feel a little bit of fear. Right, but they didn't point out to anyone that that's what they were doing. And then they ran an experiment on this. All of the participants that they contacted later, these were all males. And the tour guide who gave this tour was an attractive young female. And if you think about this little experience that you get, elevated heart rate, butterflies in the stomach, and all that, if you're not really paying attention to the surroundings and don't quite realize that the reason why you're feeling this fear is because you went across this rickety bridge, you get to the end of the tour, you look around, you think to yourself, wonder why I'm feeling like this. Oh, must be her. And so they gave all of the participants in the study the opportunity to express attraction for the tour guide by getting her phone number or actually calling back later and things like that. And what they found was that if you went across that rickety bridge, you were much more likely to make these phone calls later to express attraction for the tour guide than if you went across the big concrete and steel bridge, which is exactly what you're talking about, right? It's, you got that sort of fear response, and then you ended up interpreting it in a different way.
Yeah, something else. Mm-hmm.
So how is it that, you know, some anxiety and some fear is really debilitating for some people, and then others, it's like not a big deal?
Well, I mean, of course, we're all constituted differently based on not only our genetic predispositions, but also our experiences as well, right? So when we experience fear, all of us who have had those experiences, have experienced getting through the fear one way or another. Now, many people, when they are confronted with a fearful situation, they choose to avoid that situation. And avoiding the situation results in a diminution of all of the responses that we interpret as fear. So if you think about that, what you're learning from that is something fearful, get the hell out of there, feel better, right? Now, other people, for whatever reason, or whatever combinations of reasons, the fear response is such that you're able to push through it enough that you get to the other side. And now fear response subsides, and now you feel better. Now, those are two different paths to get to subsiding the fear response, right? One has to do with escaping, one has to do with pushing through. And many people, I think, experience things in life where they actually learn to escape, right? Because they've not experienced the pushing through and getting to it. So that asks the question of, well, how big a fearful experience does there have to be before you're able to actually push through and get to the other side? Because some fearful experiences are so daunting, no way I'm getting through that the other side of that thing, so I'm out of here, right? But others are small enough that you're able to persist and get through the thing that you're trying to get through, and getting to the other side now teaches you something about the way you deal with fear, right?
But there's also, I mean, on top of that, a lot of our fear response is designed to do things that are going to make us physiologically better at just getting the heck out of there. I mean, it's the old fight or flight response, right? So the increased heart rate, the shot of adrenaline, all that stuff is great physically, but it's actually not wonderful mentally, right? And so there's another thing that happens, which is if you begin to really elevate that fear response in a situation in which the way you get through it is intellectual, then you may actually become much more narrow, right? Your working memory capacity declines, your focus, your actual visual focus gets narrower, which is a great thing if you're trying to focus on, you know, how do I get out of here? But if you're trying to take a test or, you know, make an interesting comment in front of a room full of people, then that kind of fear can actually feed on itself. And at that point, you know, you can choke under pressure there because you don't have the mental resources to do what you want to do. And once you choke under pressure, then that becomes something else that you fear because you don't want that to happen again. I mean, if you look at top stressors in life, it's things like public speaking. I mean, in fact, a great manipulation of stress that they do in psychology experiments is to tell the participants in the studies they're going to have to give a talk in front of a group sometime later in the session, and that actually creates that kind of fear.
And that's an important thing to point out, because I'm not nervous. Art's not nervous. I don't think Rebecca's nervous either.
I'm scared to death time I get near you two.
But the thing is, this is not some magic in our genes that allow this. The fact is, we do this all the time, right? And that repeated experience, where most often the outcome is pretty good, desensitizes us to what might be a first response fear to a situation that now no longer is fearful.
And that is type of a therapy as well. So when people have phobias, they, you know, kind of, what is the word, expose them to the phobia in a safe environment over and over, and that somehow helps them get over these fears.
And one of the things that makes that happen, of course, is that you're approximating what is a genuinely fearful situation. So if somebody has a fear of flying, for example, and you go to a therapist and say, I really need to get over this, right? What most good therapists will do is they'll have you make a list of fearful things related to flying, and they'll put that list in a hierarchy. Like the top of the list is actually flying on a plane, right? But on the bottom of the list might be thinking about making a reservation to fly. And even that causes a little guts to respond.
Packing.
Yeah, packing, right? So now what a good therapist will do is begin to introduce in your imagination each of those things while you're completely relaxed. And all of the physiological responses are saying, I'm feeling really good. And now you're thinking about making a reservation. Until the thought of making a reservation is no more, it's no longer affecting your viscera as it used to, right? But it's the idea of approximating small things that have a high probability of success and then gradually increasing the intensity until you face the actual thing, whatever that is.
What is being done, some new developments treating soldiers with PTSD who are coming back from really traumatic situations, and what is that exposure therapy like? How are they dealing with that?
Wow, that's a really tough one. I mean, PTSD is extremely difficult to cure. And in fact, one of the things that they're trying to do as much as anything else is to try and predict who is most likely to suffer from PTSD while they're there. So it may very well be, I mean, we know that a certain number of soldiers go over and they come back with PTSD symptoms and others don't. And they went through exactly the same experience. So there's a belief now that there may be some factors that are actually protective of PTSD, and that for better or for worse, if you could identify those people who aren't likely to suffer from those symptoms, then you make them more likely to get into situations in which they might face danger, but would be less likely to suffer long-term consequences from that later.
And as you would guess, with the number of veterans who are returning home from having experienced very traumatic things that I can't even begin to imagine. One technique that has become a point of interest, I'm not sure we really understand it fully, is capitalizing on the idea that each time we recall a memory.
Hold your mic.
Okay, thanks. That each time we recall a memory, the memory has to be so-called reconsolidated, right? We need to reestablish the stability of the memory. So when we recall something, it actually puts what was a stable memory into a somewhat labile or unstable state. And so if you have a traumatic memory and you recall that traumatic memory, right, it's possible to set up situations in such a way that the trauma associated with the memory, the emotional baggage that comes with the memory, isn't recorded along with the actual recollection of the events. And again, this is relatively new. I mean, it's not something that I think is completely understood, well, is way far from completely understood, but it's something that I think many people who work with veterans think shows promise. And I know that veterans are not the only people with PTSD, but I mean, with people who work with people who experience this kind of trauma, seems to show some promise for long-term therapy. Yeah.
And what is the research on, say, the heritability of fear? You know, are people inheriting fearfulness? Can you do that?
You want to start?
Yep. Yeah, you can. I mean, if you think about it, again, you have these two motivational systems, the approach system, the avoidance system. When that avoidance system triggers, that creates the situation in which you can experience fear. And that's an aspect of, in part, the way that your brain is structured, and your brain structure is being determined in part by your genes. So you can get these things, and there's a variety of different things that can trigger that system, that avoidance system, to go off. There are people who are just have difficulty with new situations, right? They you know, one of the core personality dimensions is this dimension of openness to experience. And the people who are open to experience want to try new stuff. They think, wow, that's cool, I'm going to try that. And the people who are on the closed end of things, they don't want to do anything new. They really want the comfort of the familiar. And so they're going to, and in fact, often get very anxious in situations in which there's something new happening.
You know, I think there are few parents who have raised more than one child who don't accept the idea that there are genetic predispositions to personality, because children raised in the same household can be completely different. It's not just a function of, you know, they're raised in a little different circumstances because there's another kid in their house. But I don't want to get into all that. But I will say this. You know, genetic predisposition interacts with environment. It's not like if you have this particular genetic constellation of factors, therefore you're going to be this, whatever it is. I that's pretty well understood. But if you do have a slight genetic predisposition that causes you to be a little overly cautious, for example, about experiences that are unfamiliar to you or potentially in some way threatening, and early on you choose to start avoiding those circumstances, well, now what for another kid would be experiences where he or she would dive in, have the experience, think, well, that wasn't so bad, I'm going to try that again. But you're not having those experiences because initially your first response is don't do that. And now for somebody who is doing that, you're developing a different kind of thinking about novel and unfamiliar experiences. For the kid who might have a very slight predisposition that would be invisible if there were a parent or a caregiver who would say, let's go try it anyway. Let's go get on that stupid ride anyway and see what happens. You know, now, even though you had the genetic predisposition, it has no visibility at all in your behavior because you've had these experiences that have actually been more important in functioning to affect your long-term behavior than the genes were. Yeah.
While we're on the topic of children, what is it about nighttime which is so scary to children?
It's dark.
Is it because it's dark? Is it because somehow they're, you know, when they start kind of drifting off, is their imagination working differently? You know, I get scared at night.
Well, there's a lot of things. Yeah. I mean, there's a lot of things. I mean, think about it. It's dark, so you can't see what's going on. We then put you all alone. Right? So there's nobody else to govern your behavior. I mean, we do a lot of social referencing with things. You know, right now there are lots of noises happening in the room. And if one of them was a little strange, I might look at one of you and think, and if you looked at me when, then I'd get scared. But if you were like, you know, it's okay, then I'd be relaxed. Well, if you're all alone in your room at night, there's nobody there to calm you down. So that's another thing that's going on. Plus, there's a lot of noises in the world and the world starts to quiet down at night. Right. If you think about it, you know, the TV's not on anymore. The radio's not on. And now all, you know, the house creaking and the wind rustling and all that stuff. And you're now free to let your imagination run wild and interpret what in the world is going on out there. And then on top of that, and then I'll let you talk. On top of that,
I got all night.
There you go. On top of that. What happens is that you begin to interpret things related to the way your motivational system is operating. So if you start to get a little nervous, then you begin to interpret every sound as if it's something you ought to be nervous about. And if you don't believe this, I have a little exercise for all of you to try tonight. Sit in a room for 5 minutes alone and then ask yourself, I wonder if there's an intruder in the house.
Sounds fun.
Yes. You'll be up and around looking around in no time.
You know, but so this
Yes, I went to this talk at the Cactus and suddenly my whole night is screwed up. Great. Great.
But you know, this speaks to, you know, what this primal kind of development of fear, the way our brains evolved in order to understand that sleeping alone on the savannah isn't necessarily the safest thing to do. So how do we ever get to sleep?
Well, I think it's something to say about, you know, I was only half teasing when I said because it's dark, you know, as well we're afraid at night. I mean, we recognize in a very intuitive way that uncertainty is potentially dangerous, right? And so when it's dark and you don't know what's going on in the room because you can't see, and there are noises that have not yet become familiar to you, and here's another experiment you can try. When you hear noises at night in your own house and you know exactly what it is, when you say, oh, that's the faucet, or, oh, that's the ice maker, or there's no fear whatsoever. It's when you hear a noise and you don't know what it is, that's what gets your blood going a little bit, right? It's the uncertainty. And I'll make
so
one.
If you, so if you have kids at home, sit outside their room and go,
yeah. And you could traumatize just about anybody, but I think, but you know, I there's an interesting musical correlate to this, so I'll work this in. You know, one of the things that people ask is why is the beginning of Jaws, why is that music scary, even before you know what's going on? You know, why is this low sound scary? And a lot of it is because it's low. And what many people probably already know about sound waves is that low frequencies, the length of those waves is very long. And what that does for our auditory system, they're very hard to locate, which is why if you have a subwoofer in your stereo system, you can put it anywhere in the room, it doesn't matter, because your ears can't tell where it is, right? So when you hear low sounds, you can't locate them in space. And that's inherently unnerving in a way that if you hear high sounds, even if you kind of don't know what they are, you at least know which direction to run, right? And with low sounds, you're not sure which direction to run because you can't locate them in space.
Fascinating.
Yeah.
So I've just a couple questions before we open things up. What is it about sleep that allows us to compartmentalize fear and trauma from memories?
Well, so one of the things that happens with sleep, I mean, this is an interesting facet of it, is that as you begin to replay these memories that you've had, it actually, one of the things it does is to split off that emotional component. So if you think about what your brain is doing, it's not like you have a memory and it's like right there. Your memory is distributed all across the brain, and when you re-experience that memory, part of what you're doing is putting all of those pieces back together. And that means that you can remove some of those pieces as well. And one of the things that it appears you can remove is the emotional toll that memories have. And that's when they say time heals all wounds, they really mean, you know, if you sleep, that's going to heal at least some of the wounds, because it will actually remove that emotional component. You can get yourself worked up again if you need to, but in order to get yourself worked up again, you got to sort of re-experience it and sort of, you know, sort of simulate the whole thing through until you get angry, because the emotional piece of that isn't there in the memory anymore.
And just to recapitulate the thing that we kind of started out with early on tonight is, again, acknowledging the multidimensional aspects of any emotion, I mean, fear included, right? I mean, it's not just a thing. And when you start to acknowledge the fact that it's not a thing, it's multiple things, well, then you recognize, as Arch is pointing out, how it's possible to actually reconfigure the parts in a way that doesn't resemble the initial experience, whether that's done by sleep or by a good therapist or whatever it happens to be.
So last question before we open things up. Halloween is coming up on Thursday. Let's talk a little bit about terror management theory and the importance of events like Halloween.
This is my favorite named theory in all of psychology, terror management theory. And I must admit, I did get a chuckle out of that when I first read about it. But the idea is this. Human beings are probably the only species on the planet who are able to contemplate our own mortality. If you have fish, right, they probably live in blissful ignorance of the fact that someday they'll be upside down at the top of the fish tank. And so we can actually think about that fact. And so the question is, how do we deal with that? How do we deal with this? And so terror management theory is about how we deal with the potential that we could think about our own mortality. And the fascinating thing is what they do in these studies is that they bring participants in and they remind them in various ways that they are mortal beings, either by having them write about what life will be like when they're gone, or just reminding them, you know, showing them pictures of themselves and reminding them they have a physical body. And one of the things that happens when you are reminded of your own death is that you tend to grab onto things that are going to be longer lasting than you, like your own cultural traditions. Right, so you're much more interested in being patriotic, for example, in the United States, if you are reminded of your own mortality, because you assume the U.S. is going to go on longer than you, and so it's sort of really fascinating stuff, and then of course, you know, the other thing that happens is we have to figure out how do you deal with death, and so we create all of these bizarre traditions around death. So right around the time of year when it starts getting dark early, you know, we start dressing up like skeletons and zombies and things like that, and essentially make fun of death, doing a little bit of exposure therapy, right? So now we have all the trappings of death. I mean, look, I walked down my street now. There's gravestones and skeletons and all these things, and I'm laughing. Ha, 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 ha. I laugh in the face of death.
Yes. And I think another issue about that, too, is that, you know, human beings, we crave stimulation. And when you imagine what's possible for us to create stimulation for ourselves, I mean, not just fear related to Halloween. I mean, we get on roller coasters and crazy, stupid rides.
We go to exams.
Yeah, I know. We go to exams. You know, all kinds of things that create fear that we actually seek out that emotional response. And one of the things that I think that points out about us, which is interesting, is how much joy we take out of being emotionally stimulated, even when the stimulation is simulated fear. Now, what's interesting about that to me, not to beat my dead horse here, but the idea about the multidimensionality of it, is that if I'm on a roller coaster and we get to the top of the thing and turn over and I think, oh my God, and my guts are acting just as if I were actually gonna die, right? But my brain says, you're on a roller coaster, come on, you know? And so I can now contextualize all of that intellectually, even though I'm experiencing everything in my body that I would experience if I had actually run up to a precipice and was ready to fall to my death. And we actually enjoy that, right? I mean, not we, everyone, but many of us enjoy that. So seeking those experiences out, to me, is an interesting way to illustrate how the physical parts of emotions can be experienced, even if the emotional part, even if the intellectual part, is somehow divorced from the experience.
And it's another way of helping us to deal with those extreme emotional experiences. It's emotional play, right? So you go to a horror movie and you get the living stuff scared out of you, and then you survive the experience, and you think, if I could deal with that, I could deal with anything. Right, and so it actually helps you to face those things a little bit more, just because you've experienced as almost as bad as it can get, and live to tell the tale.
And this is why bad news sells better than good news. It's more stimulating.
Well, I don't know about that, I'll have to think about that. That may be, but I think what we're capable of doing when we experience emotions that we set ourselves up to experience, like going to a scary movie or going on a ride that's frightening or whatever, is that we're deliberately setting up our automatic systems in our brain to react in a way that we could not get them to react without putting us in that situation. But there are enough safety measures around, right? I'm at a theater, even though it's scary as hell, there's an exit sign, so come on, there's an exit sign. And even on a ride, I've got a safety bar on me on the roller coaster or the Ferris wheel or wherever the heck it is. And so I've been able to activate all of the experiences and yet do it in a way that I know intellectually is not actually dangerous.
And then there's one more piece to it. We're not going to let you talk again. There's one more piece to it, which is remember, when you are reminded of your own mortality, one of the things you do is you grab onto things that you believe are going to last beyond you. And one of the things you grab onto is other people around you, right? So one of the great reactions to fearful situations is that you grab on, literally, physically grab onto the people around you. And if you're looking for a great date night movie, if you can get past the fear part, after that, you're grabbing onto the person next to you, so it's okay.
Explains so much. So let's open things up for a few questions. Amy Chambliss is coming around with a rover, and if you just raise your hand, wait for her to come to you, and make sure you're on mic, because we are recording this evening. So thanks for using the euphemism that you did.
The stuff.
Hello. Hi, go ahead.
Hi, I wanted to know, what is your opinion on how well NLP works to deal with trauma or fear?
I'm sorry, would you say that one more time? I didn't hear the
whole
question.
Yes, what is your opinion on how well NLP works to deal with trauma or fear?
Uh-huh. I mean, there are lots of different ways to program yourself, right, to help you to come to grips with emotional experiences that you're having difficulty with. And one of the most powerful ways of programming your own brain is to use language, to create descriptions of things that will allow you to reconceptualize a situation that you're in. And so while I'm not a therapist and I can't endorse any particular technique, one of the things that's really amazing about language is the way that you describe things can completely change your experience of it. And so, if you begin to talk about potential fear-inducing experiences in very abstract ways, it reduces the fear that's associated with those. And if you turn them into humorous things, I mean, you ask yourself, why is there so much gallows humor? Why in dark times do people tell jokes? Well, one of the things that they're doing is using language to reprogram the brain to turn something that is awful and horrible into something that is more palatable. And that's essentially one of the things that techniques like NLP are trying to do.
And one of the things that's happening with that too is you're creating a new pairing, right? I mean, you're creating literally an associative pairing between words and ideas that already have associations with them that are not negative, and you're juxtaposing them with these situations that are potentially negative or fear-inducing, and now you've changed the nature of what you're thinking about because you've got these two things that typically don't go together, and you've put them together, like telling a joke in the midst of some horrifying idea.
And you mentioned NLP. For those of you who don't understand what that is, or what is that briefly?
It's a technique called neuro-linguistic programming that's just one of many different techniques for using things like language to help you reconceptualize what's going on in the world around you.
Next question. There's one right up front, unless... Oh, there's one in the back, too, I think.
Throw the mic.
Hello.
Catapult.
To what extent, if any, does fear play in establishing personal morals or political positions?
I'll do the moral one and you do the politics. How about that?
Thank you, Bob.
Yeah, I was afraid of that.
Exactly. I created a fear response. And you know, yeah, exactly. You know, actually, it's an interesting thing because if you think about why we do the things we do, that's one interesting question. A more interesting question, I think, is why we don't do things that we imagine we might do. And actually, you know, when you think about what evolved over time in terms of the brains of organisms, much of the appetitive kind of things that Art's talking about, the approach kinds of things, are in a part of the brain that really doesn't talk to our language part of the brain and our conscious part of the brain. And all those appetitive things that say, go get that, or I'm really, you know, pissed off at this guy and I'm gonna whack him and I really wanna do that, are moderated by a much later part of our evolutionary history that says, you know, that's not good, because you can imagine what's gonna happen next and after that and after that and after that, and because you're able to project all that into the future, you say, I know this might feel good momentarily to whack this guy, but that's probably stupid, right? Now that's an interesting thing to think about, because it's not necessarily a fear response as much as it is a recognition of consequences beyond the immediacy of the situation. Now, some people might interpret that as fear. You know, I'm not gonna do this because I'm afraid what will happen if I do. I don't know, maybe you could define it like that. But I think more broadly, the idea is you are able to create an inhibitory response because you recognize consequences that might not be in the immediate vicinity of what you're doing.
And socially, this happens too. So there are lots of things people won't do if they believe somebody's watching that they would do otherwise. And in fact, there's evidence now suggesting that people who with a strong belief in God essentially are have a belief that somebody's always watching, and so they're engaging that same social mechanism which actually prevents them from doing things because they believe that they're being watched.
I just want to add one thing to that about an interesting experiment that was done in a number of different settings, but I'll just tell you about one. You know, a lot of break rooms in offices have a coffee maker, and there's a place to put a little money in the kitty when you get a cup of coffee to pay for the coffee and everything. And one experiment that was done, again, this is speaking to the innateness of this, is above the kitty where you got the coffee, they put a picture of something neutral, like a flower or something. And of course, they had a camera in the room, and they were watching how many people were actually giving money to the kitty after they got the coffee. And then they changed the picture, and they put up a picture of eyes, humans' eyes. Of course, it was a photograph. There was nobody there, right? There's nothing behind the eyes. It's just a piece of paper with eyes on it. And the incidence of putting money in the kitty went way up, even though absolutely nothing about the circumstance changed. But somehow, brains responded to the fact that there is an idea that someone else could be watching what you're doing, and behavior changes as a result of that. And that's a remarkable thing. And it speaks to, by the way, the interesting thing about the study too, when they debriefed people after all this experiment was over, because ethically you debrief people after you do stuff like this, nobody noticed any of the pictures. You know, so it wasn't a matter of a conscious decision. It was just a matter of what's going on below conscious awareness.
And what is the relationship between the area in the brain where fear is associated and your subconscious?
Well, I mean, the fact is we're not conscious of most of what goes on in our lives. And
you're not just talking about me, are you?
No, not this time. But so we're actually blissfully unaware of a lot of what's happening. And then, you know, part of what's happening, and this, you know, gets back to some things we've been talking about and that Bob was just talking about, these areas deep in our brain, you know, the approach ones that are telling us, you know, go whack that guy, or the avoidance ones that are saying, you know, run away from the tiger, they really don't communicate well with the rest of the brain because they're buried deep. If you take a brain, okay, so here's physiology 101. brain looks like two wrinkled boxing gloves set the wrong way around. And that wrinkled part on the outside is the cortex, and it's gray. And so they helpfully call it gray matter. And then if you were to cut into the brain, just millimeters below the surface is more brain, and it's white, so they call that white matter. And then if you keep cutting through, you end up finding more gray matter deep inside the brain. And the white matter is basically it's insulated neurons, so they're wiring harnesses that are going through the brain. And when you get to that gray matter that's deep inside, that's the stuff that's phylogenetically really, really old. And that's the stuff that's driving a lot of these kinds of fear responses and appetitive approach responses. And that stuff that's deep inside there doesn't play well with others. So it doesn't communicate well to the outer part of the brain. And so it can't tell the outer part of the brain, this is why you are experiencing the emotion that you're currently having. So you basically then have to observe your own behavior and your own internal feelings and guess why it is that this is happening. And so
and that lack of communication is reciprocal, right? Because neither can the conscious part of your brain communicate with the other part and say, relax, there's nothing to be worried about. I mean, anybody who is fearful of elevators or whatever, you know, you get in a glass elevator and you say, look, this is scaring the hell out of me. I'm not going in there. No data about elevator safety is going to change your mind. You know, I mean, I can't show you how many people ride in elevators. Nobody ever gets hurt. Because what the part of my brain that's responding to that, because I know when I get in that thing, that's going down, right? That's not based on any rationality. So to try and rationality somebody out of that is a hopeless cause.
So right, and as a great example of this, Paul Rosen does all these great studies where he'll give you a piece of chocolate. Anybody like chocolate out there? Anybody? I can't see hands. I'm assuming most of the hands are up. Yeah. If I gave you that same piece of chocolate, only we'd melted it and put it in a little mold so that it looked like a cockroach, and we show you the whole process, but you get this very realistic-looking chocolate cockroach, people are much more reluctant to stick that in their mouths, even though they're saying to themselves, I know this is chocolate. I can't do this. And so there you've got that outer part of the brain telling you it's okay, and that in the inner part going, don't tell me that's okay, yeah, that's right. Not okay.
How about another question, anyone?
Yes.
One second.
I guess we could hear you. My biggest fear is I will speak and no one will
hear. I have a fear of microphones.
There you are.
I decided to come here tonight because I submitted an application to give a presentation next spring in front of a large group of people, and if it gets accepted, I'll panic. I'll say, oh, no, I have to do it. So aside from practicing speaking in a microphone to people, what can you do to really get over the fear of public speaking so that you can relax and tell a great story?
Yeah. You know, it's a fascinating thing because really when people rank their greatest fears, I mean, really, that's like at the top of a lot of people's lists. Yeah.
And by the way, right, notice that you applied for this talk months early, which is actually really interesting too. So psychological distance is a great way of lowering the arousal, the energy that comes with that situation. And so, you know, you know that you might be afraid of speaking in public, but months ahead of time you send that application out because the interest in giving the talk is far greater than any fear in that moment months out. As it gets closer, there may be more, don't worry about it, there may be a little more fear. One of the things that you can do,
and we really hope we've helped you so far.
But there are several things you can do. One is actually to use that concept of distance, right? So for example, until a few minutes ago when they turned the lights back up, we couldn't actually see anybody here. And in many situations where you get up to speak in front of really large groups of people, it turns out you can't see anyone, so you may as well be alone, right? So you can create some social distance to help you calm down. But then to get back to something Bob was saying earlier, probably the best thing you can do between now and the time that you have to give the big talk is to give a lot of little talks. I mean, it's amazing how well that works, because the more that you get up in front of people and give talks, the less The more you realize that what's the worst thing that could happen, right? Nobody's gonna recognize you later anyhow.
But I think the big thing about this is that what I think many people are looking for. I don't know what you're looking for this, but many people are looking for how do I need to think my way out of this? And the answer is you can't think your way out of it because you didn't think your way into it, right? Because in reality, you know in a clear moment, nothing bad can happen to you, right? I mean, you might be embarrassed, maybe, but I mean, nothing physically is gonna. Yeah, stop it.
Take a trip.
I know it's Halloween. Yeah. Again, we hope we've helped, but in a calm moment, you know that's the case. So the thing is, what you've got to teach is the part of your brain that doesn't listen to have experiences that are contravening what its fear is about. So you give a little talk. So you go to elementary school and you talk to a classroom of kids for 5 minutes. And a very non-judgmental group who will just be happy there's a new person in the room, you know? And then you leave. And there's a happy
like
thing.
Like teenagers.
Yeah, God. I've decided we have to cut his microphone off now. But I mean, you put yourself in situations where the consequences are like really low for anything negative happening. And those experiences, are talking to a part of your brain that you or I or your therapist can't talk to.
Absolutely.
Yeah, exactly.
Absolutely.
Exactly.
And lick you for it.
But is there, I heard a really interesting interview with Leonard Cohen, and he said every time he gets on stage, he's nervous.
But he
uses that fear.
Sure. Well, so two things. First of all, Leonard Cohen probably shouldn't be anyone's guide to behavior. I say this with great affection, okay? But it is true, you don't want to get blasé about things either, right? I mean, we've all seen performers who get up and mail it in. You know, they've done this 1,000 times before, and they're like, thank you, Austin, you know? And that's no good either. So you certainly want there to be a little bit of, energy, nervousness. And so drawing a little bit of nervousness from the fact that you're in this situation, which would give you some energy and enthusiasm. I think that's a good thing.
I think the phrase that coaches use a lot is being up, but not uptight. Right. Because certainly when you have heightened awareness, you're thinking faster often, right? I mean, your mind's going faster, you're a little bit more alert, you're noticing more things that are going on. So a little bit of adrenaline, and I probably lied a little bit earlier when I said, we're not nervous at all about this. Well, I mean, come on, you come to the cactus, there might be four people here and they're throwing stuff. We don't know that.
Like last time, right.
But I mean to be in a situation where the initial feelings create a heightened awareness and a heightened sensitivity to what's going on is actually advantageous in many situations, right? But if that becomes so overwhelming that now it's a distractor from the things you need to be paying attention to, now it's a bad thing.
So now you're going to get jargon. There were these two guys named Yerkes and Dodson back at the beginning of the 20th century, and they created what they call the Yerkes-Dodson curve, which is still in use. And so, I mean, that's like the pinnacle of achievement in the field of psychology, to have something named after you that 105 years later people can still remember. And what the Yerkes-Dodson curve says is if you look at the relationship between performance in a task and so your level of performance and your degree of arousal, your degree of energy, at really low levels of arousal, let's see, what the graph would be this way for you guys, at really low levels of arousal, your performance is bad because you just can't be bothered to do anything. And then as you get more and more arousal, more and more energy, you get better and better and better. And that's not the surprising part. The surprising part is then you go over the cliff into what we sometimes call panic or choking or things like that, where more and more energy actually decreases your performance. And so what you really want, they're literally, when people talk about being in the zone, there literally is a zone with this moderate level of arousal that is perfect for your performance. And then there are individual differences in how naturally high arousal you are, which is why you need to get to know yourself. So some people, the kinds of people who get things done way in advance, right? They have naturally high arousal. So they start working on stuff really early. So when deadlines come or they have to stand up in front of a group, they get pushed over the edge. And then there are other people where a small thermonuclear device needs to be detonated beneath their seat before they look up. those people, right, they need extreme deadline pressure in order to get anything started. And for those people, they might just hit the zone when they're in front of 50,000 people.
I think we have time for one more question. Or how much time do we have? Casey's got my phone because he forgot his, so I don't know. Okay, we have time for a couple more then. That's great.
I married somebody who enjoys scary movies, and I hate them. Not only because a lot of times they're dumb, but they stay, in my imagination way too long.
So not that dumb.
Yeah. Is there anything I can do short of just watching a lot of them to get over those fears and that that nervousness? Like I start sweating. I get scared.
Yeah, and I think again what that illustrates is you're having a physiological response that's being triggered by the events that you're witnessing in a movie theater. And again, that physiological response evolved because it was advantageous, right? To have that response in the presence of something that was fearful and potentially dangerous. But now that you're not really in a situation that's dangerous, you can't get out of it by just realizing that, right? But, you know, I think one of the things that's interesting, again, we're not therapists, but I'm going to give you some advice
clearly
about what to do this, right? Yeah, yeah. But we play them on TV.
Radio.
On the radio, right. But one of the things that I think, if you take time to imagine movies that you've seen, right, and recall them, in a situation where now you're responsible for calling up whatever the creepy thing was that happened that freaked you out when you watched yeah, like that. That it, when you're doing that, and now you're in the, you're controlling the timing. I mean, what makes movies scary is the same thing that makes movies funny, right? It's timing. It's not the fact that something happens. Is it something that you did? Yeah, right. That's something that you didn't anticipate was going to happen, right? I mean, that's the thing that makes it scary. I mean, if you had a warning like 5 minutes in a minute, something's going to jump out of there. Yeah, no big deal, right?
Coming now.
That's right. So if you now instead say there's only things happening when I don't expect it. You know, you think the guy's dead, and then the guy turns around, and there's what my wife calls the pop-up. You know, where he pops up again, he's still alive. That's what makes it scary. So you being able to recall it, and it's not a timing that you can't anticipate because you're willing that back into your recollection, right? So now you're thinking about that, you're calm, and now you're experiencing this in a totally different way that you would if you just went to a lot of movies. Because if you keep getting scared the same way in the movies, that's not going to do anything. You're just going to keep getting scared, right?
Yeah. No, but that said, I'm willing to bet. You know, one of the things that Bob and I talk a lot about is the fact that as human beings, one of the great things about being human is our ability to control our own environment. And so there are certain things in life that the way to avoid experiencing them is simply to avoid them. And I am willing to bet that your husband that your husband has some friends who enjoy horror films, and I'll bet he also has activities that you enjoy that he doesn't like at all. And so, you know, maybe not everything needs to be experienced together.
Okay. We do have time for a couple more questions. So go ahead.
Separating couples all night
long. No, not permanently.
Relationship
for
therapy.
2 hours.
Just don't talk.
Hey, honey, I went to this thing tonight. Ron, you're on.
Go ahead. One more question.
Okay. I found it interesting your response to the time heals all wounds topic. Am I speaking in a low tone so you can't find the direction on where?
It's just coming through the monitor. It sounds like you're right there.
I don't normally get that response. Typically, people... Okay. Time. And just turn it off. Dang it, you just found me. And she disappears. Okay, here we go. Let's rewind.
Yeah.
Okay. Time heals all wounds. And they're pieces of your brain that, as you sleep, remove the emotion of those? Is that what?
Well, it's that they're part of the sleep process. So memories are not videotapes that fade over time. They are that what when you experience something for the first time, then neurons in, all over your brain are making connections that are helping you to recreate aspects of the experience that you had when you originally experienced this thing, and that's what we experience as a memory. So in some sense, when you have a memory of something, you are re-engaging neurons in your brain in patterns that are similar to what happened when you experienced this the first time, and you're replaying it. But because the pieces of your brain, the areas of your brain that are re-experiencing that are distributed all through your brain, not all of them need to get turned back on in order for you to experience some portion of that memory. And what sleep seems to be doing is to take those areas of the brain that are most responsible for giving you emotional content to the experience and making those areas of the brain less responsive when the other areas of the brain kick in. And because those become less responsive, and this happens over the course of sleep, over time when you sleep, that lack, that lower level of responsiveness means that you can then re-experience the memory without re-experiencing the emotional content of it because that those areas of your brain aren't being reactivated.
And we know that dreams are associated with rapid eye movement sleep, called because another brilliant label in psychology because your eyes are moving very fast. So it's called rapid eye movement sleep. But another name for rapid eye movement sleep is paradoxical sleep. And the reason it's called that,
oddly enough,
is that when you're in rapid eye movement sleep, all of your musculature and the connections from your brain to your musculature is shunted. Because if it wasn't, when you're dreaming you're walking, you'd actually be walking, right? Or if you were dreaming that you were getting up and moving around, you would actually be, your body would be doing that. So how can you have a dream where you imagine something, right, and not have your body up and moving around while you're still thinking about it, right? So one of the things that evolution has designed is this shunt that during rapid eye movement sleep, called paradoxical sleep, you lose muscle tone. So you're just limp. And one of the things that's interesting about that is you think about many of the fear responses that we experience or the hurtful responses that we experience. And we say they're in our guts because it does feel like that, and they actually are because our viscera are actually reacting in ways that at some point was advantageous evolutionarily. But now we're imagining the memory, all the visual aspect of it, the auditory aspect of it, other kinesthetic aspects of it are all now in our memory, all in our sleeping consciousness, and yet our viscera are disconnected. So that over time now decouples that feeling from the imagining of whatever the experience happened to be. It's a cool thing.
You know, one thing too, which maybe you could briefly talk about because I think it's so fascinating, is what our brain does to negative and positive images over sleep too. So if we're deprived of sleep, we're more likely to remember negative things.
You know, one of the things that's really interesting in terms of sleep deprivation. I mean, Art and I are spending our days around college students, and none of them sleep enough. And I tell them that all the time. I said, you need to sleep more. And there's sort of become an ethic that if you're really, you know, if you're aggressive and you're assertive and you want to make stuff happen, you know, you just keep working and who needs sleep and that kind of thing. But actually, there's a consequence of that because sleep has a function, and it's to organize and consolidate and facilitate the memories of the things that we experience during the day that somehow have gotten a trigger that this is something to keep, right? So if you're not sleeping, that's not happening. That's a bad thing. But now the emotional part. Some work that's been done in Berkeley by a terrific guy named Matthew Walker, who was a postdoc at Harvard and now is runs this sleep and neuroimaging lab at Berkeley, that indicates that if you are deprived of sleep, if one is deprived of sleep, and this is a particular experiment, subjects were shown a bunch of images that varied in their emotional valence. So some were very negative, like a car accident or something, and some were neutral, like a facade of a building, and some were, you know, lovely, like a mother holding a baby or something. And they showed a big array of pictures. But they were sleep-deprived after that. And, I'm sorry, they were sleep-deprived before they saw the pictures. They came back the next day, right? And now they were much more likely to remember the negative pictures than the positive pictures. Right, and what that really illustrates is how much of a re-regulating function sleep is involved in terms of our emotions. And so if we're sleep deprived, and you know probably people who've experienced endogenous depression in their lives, you know that one of the symptoms of that is often a sleeplessness. And if you think now,
in an escalating way, how with each day, what you're remembering most of is the crappy stuff that happened to you the day before. And that now looms larger and larger in your brain. So sleep has a tremendously important restorative function in terms of emotionality, in addition to whatever kind of memories we keep related to verbal things or visual things, that kind of stuff. Yeah.
Last question.
You have to get the mic, though. Where is Amy?
There's a guy up here
in the front.
He's got a question. You got a mic. Yeah. Pass that puppy. There we go.
So, you know, back in the college days, let's go there.
As I recall.
Back in the, yeah, you know, so what does your brain go when you drink a lot and then you have this blackout phase? And then you're still moving around and you're doing your thing, but you're like a zombie in a sense. So what is that thing?
So, well, a lot of it is actually that you disrupt the memory formation for, you disrupt those processes of forming the memories. So for those people who engage in some sort of substance use way back in the day, or since one of my kids is here, never, when that happens, you disrupt one of the areas. So for example, on each side of your brain, you have this little area called the hippocampus, shaped like a seahorse, hence the hippocampus. And it's if you saw the movie Memento, that's the area of the brain that was damaged in the guy who couldn't remember anything new. Well, you know, if you do enough of some of these substances, you can disrupt those areas. And so part of what happens is you're consciously aware in the moment. If I asked you at the time, you know, be blurry and slow, but there's something going on, but you've disrupted enough of that system that none of it's being stored, and so when you get up the next day, there's a blank space where time should have been.
One of the reasons this is usually the things that are not stored are often unhappy things that are not being stored. Is that one of the things that alcohol or many other substances are doing, particularly things that are generally depressive in nature, is they limit the inhibitory responses that keep us from doing crazy stuff that we would do if we were of our right mind. So we think, did I really do that? You can't believe it. So two things are functioning. First of all, your inhibition's diminished or gone, and now you're doing that crazy stuff. And then maybe this is a self-protection mechanism. Your memory doesn't work, so you don't even know what happened. Right, so I don't know. We never thought about that before.
Which was evolutionarily advantageous prior to Facebook.
That's it.
Instagram.
Yeah, it's Instagram. Right.
So on that note, we do have to wrap up really quick. But before we go, so what is the really exciting research now on fear and the brain? What's being done? What are you guys thinking about? What's going on in the field?
I don't know.
Well, I actually think the stuff that Bob was talking about the reconsolidation of fear memories and the ability, the prospect that might actually help to dampen the symptoms of PTSD. That's some pretty cool fear research.
But you know, I just have to say things about the research, especially Halloween's coming up, so I got a Halloween thing, right? This is great fun, and when you're with kids, you know, one of the things that Halloween helps kids learn to do is go into what is initially a fearful situation, an unfamiliar situation, and actually have a lovely experience. You know, so all the times you go to neighbors' houses and somebody comes out with some spooky, crazy thing on, you know, and your kids get scared and they giggle, that's a wonderful thing for children, you know. And I think the more kids are exposed to those kinds of things, it creates an adaptability that advantages them all throughout their life.
And then give them candy.
That's right. That's right. So Halloween, good thing.
Yeah.
Well, on that note, be sure to enjoy your Halloween and come out for our next Views and Brews, which will be on Chet Baker, November 11th.
Hey.
And so that should be a fun one for sure. And join us on Facebook, if you're sober, if you're not, it doesn't matter. KUT's Views and Brews. And we're also on Twitter at Two Guys on Your Head. And I do believe that, Professor Art Markman, you have a few books that you might be willing to sell to people tonight.
I do.
So stick around, buy a book, have another drink perhaps.
And actually, before Rebecca says goodnight, I have to say one thing that doesn't get said often enough. The reason all this stuff works
is that woman right there.
Give it up for Rebecca.
I mean, really.
I mean, right. In all seriousness, I don't know if any of you have heard the show, the radio show that we've been doing, and thank you, one. But
thanks, Mom.
But Bob and I go into the studio and talk for a long, long, long time, and it's crazy. And then at some point on the other end of this, I think she pieces together individual words and strings them together into sentences because we come off sounding semi-coherent in ways that we never thought possible. So
it's
really,
all magic.
It's incredible. And I have to tell you, the takeaway from this is that makes it such a joy to do all this, like tonight and the show and everything, is Rebecca has an unbridled, exuberant curiosity. And I can't think of a nicer thing for a human being to have than that. So anyway, thank you, love. And
thank you.
And thank you all for coming tonight.
Thank you, Bob. And thank you, Art. Thank you. And thank you, everyone, for coming out and have a wonderful night. Thanks.